encouraged NSO and two other companies to continue working with Saudi Arabia and issued a new license for a fourth to do similar work, overriding any concerns about human rights abuses. Since then, Saudi Arabia has continued to use the spyware to monitor dissidents and political opponents. The fact that the Zionist regime has encouraged its private companies to do security work for the kingdom is yet more evidence of the reordering of traditional alliances in the region and the strategy by the Israeli regime and several Persian Gulf countries to join forces. NSO is by far the best known of the Israeli regime firms, largely because of revelations in the last few years that its Pegasus program was used by numerous regimes to spy on and eventually imprison human rights activists. NSO sold Pegasus to Saudi Arabia regime in 2017. The kingdom used the spyware as part of a ruthless campaign to crush dissent inside the kingdom and to hunt down Saudi dissidents abroad. It is not publicly known whether Saudi Arabia used Pegasus or other Israeli regime-made spyware in the plot to kill Khashoggi. NSO has denied that its software was used. The Zionist regime's Ministry of War also licensed for Saudi work a company called Candiro, which Microsoft accused last week of helping its regime clients spy on more than 100 journalists, politicians, dissidents, and human rights advocates around the world. Microsoft, which conducted its investigation in tandem with Citizen Lab, a research institute at the University of Cerrano, said Candiro had used malware to exploit a vulnerability in Microsoft products, enabling its regime clients to spy on perceived enemies. Candiro has had at least one contract with Saudi Arabia regime since 2018. The Zionist regime has also granted licenses to at least two other firms, Variant, which was licensed before the Khashoggi killing, the Quadrim, which signed a contract with Saudi Arabia after the killing. A fifth company, Celebrite, which manufactures physical hacking systems for mobile phones, has also sold its services to the Saudi regime, but without ministry approval, according to the newspaper Haaretz. The Zionist regime war ministry declined to respond to specific questions about the licenses it gave to the Israeli firms, but said that a wide range of security, diplomatic, and strategic considerations are taken into account when considering whether to grant a license to export offensive cyber technology. Revelations about the abuses of NSO products led the company to hire a group of outside consultants in 2018 to provide advice about which new clients NSO should take on and which to avoid. The group included Daniel Shapiro, the former Obama administration ambassador to the occupied territories, and Beacon Global Strategies, a Washington strategic consulting firm. Beacon is led by Jeremy Bash, a former CIA and Pentagon chief of staff, Michael Allen, a former staff director for the House Intelligence Committee, and Andrew Shapiro, a former top State Department official. While the group's mandate was to vet potential new clients, the international outrage over Khashoggi's killing in October 2018 led the group to advise NSO to cancel its Saudi contracts and shut down NSO systems in the kingdom. Separately, NSO conducted an internal investigation into whether any of its tools were used by Saudi regime officials for the Khashoggi operation and concluded that they were not. However, a lawsuit against NSO by a friend of Khashoggi's claimed that his phone had been hacked by the Saudi Arabia regime using Pegasus, and that hack gave Saudi officials access to his conversations with Khashoggi, including communications about opposition projects. Over several days in late 2018, executives both of NSO and the private equity firm that owned it at the time, Francisco Partners, met in Washington with the advisory group. According to several people familiar with the meetings, the NSO executives argued that the Israeli regime was strongly encouraging the company to weather the storm and continue its work in Saudi Arabia. They also said that the Israeli officials had indicated to them that the Trump administration also wanted NSO's work with Saudi Arabia to continue. In the end, NSO management heeded the advice of the outside group and canceled its contracts with Saudi Arabia in late 2018. Mr. Shapiro, the former ambassador to the occupied territories, ended his work for the company shortly afterward. Months later, however, after another private equity firm bought NSO, the company was once again doing business with Saudi Arabia regime. NSO's new owner, Noval Pina, rejected the advice of the outside advisory group, and NSO resumed its work in Saudi Arabia in mid-2019. Around that time, Beacon ended its work with NSO. The new contract with the Saudis came with some restrictions. For example, NSO set up its system to block any attempt by Saudi officials to hack European telephone numbers, according to a person familiar with the programming. But it is clear that Saudi Arabia has continued to use NSO software to spy on perceived opponents abroad. In one case that has come to light, 36 phones belonging to journalists at Al Jazeera, which Saudi Arabia considers a threat, were hacked using NSO's Pegasus software last year, according to Citizen Lab. Citizen Lab traced 18 of the attacks back to Saudi intelligence. After the revelation of the attack on Al Jazeera journalists, NSO recently shut down the system, and at a meeting in early July, the company's board decided to declare new deals with Saudi Arabia off-limits, according to a person familiar with the decision. The Zionist regime's war ministry is currently fighting lawsuits by Israeli rights activists demanding that it release details about its process for granting the licenses. The Israeli regime also imposes a strict secrecy on the companies that receive the licenses, threatening to revoke them if the companies speak publicly about the identity of their clients. An NSO statement said the company could not discuss the identity of its customers, but added, "As NSO has previously stated, our technology was not associated in any way with the heinous murder of Jamal Khashoggi. This includes listening, monitoring, tracking, or collecting information," unquote. Officials with Candiro, Variant, and regime of Saudi Arabia declined to comment. Officials with Quadrim could not be reached. These business ties came as the Zionist regime was quietly building relationships directly with the Saudi regime. Benjamin Netanyahu, then Israeli regime's prime minister, met several times with Saudi Arabia's day-to-day ruler, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, and military and intelligence leaders of the two regimes meet frequently. While Saudi Arabia was not officially party to the Abraham Accords, the diplomatic initiatives during the end of the Trump administration normalizing relations between Israeli regime and several Arab regimes, Saudi leaders worked behind the scenes to help broker the deals.
We the people. Surfside Tragedy.
An incessantly rising death toll in the wake of a horrendous collapse. A tragedy combined with a quest for accountability and a boost in infrastructure. Nearly 100 people have died after a 12-story beachfront condominium in the Miami suburb of Surfside, Florida, collapsed, causing shockwave among the United States' communities.
Lucia was always super, like, energetic and loving. She was a friend to the entire class.
Late tonight, Lucia and her younger sister, Emma, were confirmed among the victims, along with their father, Marcus Guara, identified earlier. But their mother, Anna, is still missing.
After this happened, it has brought a ton of my friends and a lot of my family closer together, because you really do have to cherish every breath, because you never know when it could be your last.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Mila Javamardi, and in this episode, we try to get to the bottom of what happened there, what the families of the victims are going through, and really, who is to blame. In this show, we also take a look at the other incidents, such as flooding in New York City stations, and investigate whether a pattern is emerging when it comes to the U.S. infrastructure. Thank you for staying with us.
Despite what many people think, this building was screaming for years about its symptoms and about what was impending doom, and countless individuals and entities knew about this, although they didn't appreciate it. They knew, as I just mentioned a moment ago, about the symptoms, including engineering firms, the association, and even the neighboring properties knew quite well that there were significant cracks, that this building was losing height.
The search and rescue operation following a deadly condo collapse in Surfside, Florida, is painstakingly slow, and still more than 20 people remain listed as missing, their bodies not yet recovered. On the other hand, a damaged but standing section of the condo turned into a prison for those who live there. The authorities decided to demolish that portion of the building 11 days later, as a hurricane was about to make landfall in northern Florida.
The concern initially with that building still standing is that if there's a secondary collapse or there's a shift in that structure, there was still significant debris hanging over our heads, and it was too risky, and things were constantly falling, that if one small piece of brick falls from that height, it'll kill a first responder.
Did you have a moment where you felt the clear and present danger to yourself and your teams?
Well, I think still there's still clear and there's still significant dangers out there. There's plenty of rebar sticking out. We're using heavy machinery. We're using saws that can easily cut through somebody. So we have to do it safely as possible. But I understand there's risk. The whole time we've been here, there's going to be risk. And, you know, we want to operate as safely as possible, but we understand that there's also risk involved with this.
As many remain unaccounted for, the family's suffering looks unlikely to abate. The search operation kicked off after the collapse on the remaining pile of rubble, where rescue workers kept peeling layers of debris, mostly to find dead bodies. Our first guest is author and attorney Michael Springman. Welcome to the program, sir. Who is indeed responsible for the deadly building collapse in Surfside, Miami?
Well, the blame can be spread far and wide. You've got the people in the Miami-Dade area governments who issued building permits and failed to inspect them properly, failed to investigate what was really going on in the construction of the building. You've got the structural engineers who designed it, and you've got the condominium itself who failed to heed the warnings of their own inspectors 3 years ago, and you've got a condominium board that was taking in $1 million a year in condo fees but failed to apply them to the building.
Many thanks, Michael. We'll hear more of your analysis later on in the program.
It is difficult to say when the bodies of all victims of this tragedy will be recovered, but the authorities hope to conclude their painstaking work in the coming weeks. The search and recovery effort at the collapsed Champlain Towers South is set to continue for a while. An investigation is also crucial to get to the root cause of the deadly incident. The authorities are launching a grand jury investigation, and at least 6 lawsuits have been filed by the families of the victims.
I heard a noise, and to me it was like a thunder. I went to the window to see what happened. When I opened the balcony window, it was a lot of dust. Then I realized it was not raining. I closed the door, and when I was coming in, I heard a tremendous noise, and the apartment moved violently. So I went to the bedroom, pick up a flashlight. In the way out, I have my purse in the table next to the door, and I just grabbed my purse and I went out. When I opened the door, all the hallway was full of dust and was nobody there anymore.
The families of the victims are taking legal actions. As lawsuits pile up, the families are hoping to get their hands on any information that can explain the cause for the deadly Champlain Towers South condo building collapse, or any person or entity that might bear some responsibility. We're now joined by academic and commentator Paul Sheldon Foote to investigate the issue further. Sir, let me ask you this. What does the huge collapse of such a building say about infrastructure and policies related to it in the United States?
This is an old story in America. When Obama became president, he said, "I have shovel-ready projects to go." He was a Democrat. The Senate and the House were Democrats. You show me the achievements that happened during those first 2 years, nothing. Everyone in America agrees we have desperate needs to improve our infrastructure. However, you had the Democrats who want to propose huge sums of money on things that have nothing to do with infrastructure.
The deadly collapse turned into a political issue soon after it transpired that the authorities' negligence played a major role in the catastrophe. A Maryland-based consultant found evidence of a failing concrete slab and abundant cracking and crumbling to an underground parking garage during a 2018 inspection of the building and recommended repair work that was never carried out. The consultant submitted a 2018 report which ominously warned, "The failed waterproofing is causing major structural damage to the concrete structural slab below these areas. Failure to replace the waterproofing in the near future will cause the extent of the concrete deterioration to expand exponentially." A subsequent report earlier this year corroborated the poor conditions, suggesting that the probability of a collapse had increased.
Okay, so now I've slowed it down for you and enhanced the video as best I could. And what we're looking at here, this is the gate on the ramp that leads down below grade into the garage. So what you're seeing is a water pipe hanging down that's just gushing huge amounts of water. But look all over the ramp, you're seeing huge chunks of concrete, that's what it looks like, that may have fallen off of the ceiling or other columns. So what you were looking at right there, folks, is the collapsed pool deck that came down on top of the garage, and it ripped down probably the sprinkler pipe.
Yet the authorities took no action, and their negligence cost so many lives and resulted in this terrible tragedy. What are the demands of the victims today, and what should the authorities do after such a tragedy?
Well, the people involved in the collapse of the buildings, their friends, their relatives, and so on, are demanding justice and are expressing a great deal of anger and want an explanation as to what's happening. The government's responsibility, of course, is that they failed to initially oversee the construction properly and with the proper permits and the proper inspections. And now it's up to them to do a real, decent, detailed investigation of who is responsible and what was done or what was failed to be done. And I hope that they will finally get enough pressure to do a decent investigation.
While repairs had not begun immediately after the 2018 report, has its roots in the political power play rampant in America at all governmental, state, and local levels. An association that used to operate the building simply argues that the report had not warned of an actual collapse, and had they known such a disaster was about to happen, they would definitely take action to prevent it sooner.
So you see how just by knowing the layout here of the garage and where she's going, we're starting to map out where all the water damage was and where all of the leaks appear to be. Okay, so she's standing in the... This is right over the main driving area right in front of Space 53, looks like. And just look how you have stalactites forming here. I don't even know what these, if these are bolts or if they were bent rebar or what, or if there was something here at some other point in time. I can't even tell what that is. It's just, it's not really clear enough. But this is clear enough. You can see the exposed rebar right there.
The Surfside incident certainly highlights the aging and poor to mediocre condition of the country's infrastructure in general. For example, over 42% of the 617,000 bridges in the United States are more than 50 years old, according to the Infrastructure Report card.
And you have many politicians who want to spend money on worthless projects. So we joke about the bridge to nowhere, or putting in a train line that goes to the hometown of a member of Congress or something. Even on the projects that they agree upon tend to be very wasteful. And so we're in a terrible situation. The American infrastructure continues to deteriorate, and yet you have this massive game playing among politicians who have no trouble spending trillions of dollars on endless wars and weakening America and not spending money on real infrastructure projects.
The rather decrepit infrastructure and decades of negligence in specific sectors are not without consequences. Take what happened in New York City when heavy downpours fell recently. The most populous city in the United States, New York City, has a notorious flaw in its subway system.
The century-old subway is not only vulnerable to heavy rains, because even in a dry year, as nearly as 50,000 cubic meters of water has to be pumped out due to frequent leakages. The subway system is based on stopping streams of spring water to zigzag under the city, and also surrounded by the groundwater that runs beneath the whole city. And there are the people who have to commute every day.
In some areas, you're going to have lots of empty houses that nobody wants. And in other areas, you're going to have people scrambling and try to move into new areas and find that they have to commute long distances to get to work, for example. What the Biden administration proposes to do about that, I haven't seen anything yet of any value about what they could possibly do. You have the private sector housing corporations building as fast as they can. From the standpoint of what they could ever do in the public sector, I haven't seen anything.
Recurrence of incidents such as the recent Surfside tragedy or the NYC subway flooding presents a clear indication that the US has a serious infrastructure problem. Experts estimate that trillions of dollars are required to address issues with America's crumbling backbone.
Would it be worth spending the millions of dollars in infrastructure improvements to deal with these rare flooding events?
Absolutely not. Because the cost of repair would be much less than the cost of investment, and the subway needs so much other investment.
And in worst-case scenarios like yesterday, the MTA should simply close the stations quickly until the water recedes.
The subway still has to address cleaning up, addressing this, figuring out what's going to happen next time, and just hoping that these 3-inch-an-hour rains don't come more than once a summer.
The gradual decaying of public service facilities is just a natural phenomenon bound to happen unless the authorities regularly observe the status of infrastructure, report issues, and get proportionate funding in return. But in many cases, like the New York City subway, the problems are fundamental as structures have not been properly designed and originally well built in the first place. Their houses are no exception.
Housing is very difficult because of economic shifts. With the pandemic, for example, we've had large numbers of people deciding that they want to live in small areas and work online. There's been a lot of movement to the smaller areas away from the big cities, for example. You have people frequently moving around the country to different states for job openings. So it is really difficult to anticipate all the housing needs and where they'll be overnight.
The American Society of Civil Engineers has given the U.S. infrastructure a C grade. Preventing such a tragedy from happening again involves comprehensive overhaul in the country's infrastructure, as well as the way it treats nature. Meanwhile, the families remain resilient in their calls for an answer, and they demand accountability, as the U.S. President Joe Biden put it himself.
When the accident took my wife and my family, the hardest part was, were my boys going to get out? Could they going to make it? And not knowing. When you're flying home from Washington, you get the news, you know, you just don't know. So, but I was amazed. As you know, unfortunately, I've done a lot of these circumstances where I've met with families who have had great loss. And what amazed me about this group of people was their resilience, their absolute commitment, their willingness to do whatever it took to find an answer.
With sea levels rising, inspectors failing to carry out tougher reviews, and loose building codes, the probability of Surfside-like collapses rise. The significance of the money surrounding the issue could be traced back to the power struggle between Democrats and Republicans, ensuing President Biden's infrastructure plan worth trillions of dollars. How do you think the government and the states could prevent catastrophes such as the Surfside collapse from happening again?
Simply much more supervision, much more control over permits, much more control over the kinds of companies and the experience and the equipment and the actual workmen involved. Do they have the capabilities to do this? Are they doing it safely? Are they doing it according to the rules and regulations and county permits and building codes? And they've got to be a lot tougher on inspections. The Americans have been more interested in wars around the world than actual examination and repair of their own failing infrastructure.
U.S. authorities need to get their act together to address weaknesses in planning, coordination, and financing with regards to infrastructure. But in reality, the infrastructure plan proposed by President Biden has come under harsh criticism by Republicans, who argue that it is a vehicle to promote a radical left agenda.
Infrastructure, which is the bait, but the details involve more money for electric cars than for most projects that most of us consider infrastructure. And, of course, a massive tax increase, undoing the 2017 tax bill, which produced the biggest, the best economy in 50 years as recently as February of 2020, or a bill styled as voting rights, which in fact is a carefully designed plan for the Democrats to take over all of American elections all across the country.
Democrats in Congress reached a compromise on an infrastructure plan so as to brand it as a bipartisan initiative. But they are also planning to pass a much bigger package with no Republican support. That has widened the rift between the aisles, prompting a response from former President Trump. He has called on Republicans not to be played by Biden's tricks to advance the liberal agenda.
There are huge differences in what you get for your money as you go around in different parts of the country in terms of that. In terms of safety, the regulation of the building is done locally in politics. It depends very much on how strict and how honest the governmental regulatory bodies are in dealing with this. And so you can see huge differences. You can see some really shoddy situations.
The victims of inadequate investment and poor maintenance of infrastructure are the average people. And like myriad other phenomena, a broken infrastructure does not impact all sections of the community equally. While everyone uses it, deficiencies in infrastructure primarily affect the poor and the disadvantaged, much more so than the well-off sections of the community. The economic and social impact on the poor is much more pronounced.
Our budget goes on rents and food, anything that's not covered by health insurance.
Let me take this shirt off.
You got another one on. Clothing is a big thing for five kids.
Yeah.
It's a program. They help out a lot with healthy food. Then you can get some vouchers with them. Beans, cheese, milk.
I cook a lot of spaghetti because it usually lasts longer.
Experts argue that poor infrastructure leads to fewer jobs and lower incomes. It also restructures the economy to lower paying jobs as the demand rises for workforce needed to address issues related to infrastructure. Research has meanwhile proven that the application of projects such as bridges, roads, communication, sewage and electricity systems directly contribute to a reduction in poverty. Well, that was our show. I'm your host, Milad Javamardi. Join us again next week on We the People.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Leaked data reveals that a Zionist company's hacking tool has been used to facilitate human rights violations around the world on a massive scale, says Kenny Stencil writer in an article titled, Massive Data Leak Shows Israeli Regime Spyware Targeted Journalists Around the World. Stay tuned for more. So Group, a private Israeli regime firm that sells surveillance technology to governments worldwide, insists that its Pegasus spyware is used only to investigate terrorism and crime. Leaked data, however, reveals that the company's hacking tool has been used to facilitate human rights violations around the world on a massive scale. That's according to an investigative report published recently by the Pegasus Project, a media consortium of more than 80 journalists from 17 news outlets in 10 countries. The collaborative endeavor was coordinated by Forbidden Stories, a Paris-based media nonprofit, with technical assistance from Amnesty International, which conducted cutting-edge forensic tests on smartphones to identify traces of the military-grade spyware. The Guardian, one of the newspapers involved in the analysis, reported that Pegasus is a malware that infects iPhones and Android devices to enable operators of the tool to extract messages, photos, and emails, record calls, and secretly activate microphones. The Washington Post, another partner in the investigation, noted that the tool can infect phones without a click. A massive data leak turned up a list of more than 50,000 phone numbers that, according to the Post, are concentrated in countries known to engage in surveillance of their citizens and also known to have been clients of NSO Group, a worldwide leader in the growing and largely unregulated private spyware industry. More phone numbers are based in Mexico than any other country, with over 15,000 on the list, including those belonging to politicians, union representatives, journalists, and other government critics, the Post noted. As The Guardian reported, the phone number of a freelance Mexican reporter, Celicio Pineda Bercho, was found in the list, apparently of interest to a Mexican client, in the weeks leading up to his murder, when his killers were able to locate him at a car wash. His phone has never been found, so no forensic analysis has been possible to establish whether it was infected. Other nations that either had large shares of numbers on the list or were deemed to be potential government clients of NSO include France, Hungary, Turkey, Morocco, Togo, Algeria, Rwanda, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Dubai, Qatar, Bahrain, Yemen, India, Pakistan, Azerbaijan, and Kazakhstan. While the presence of a phone number in the data does not reveal whether a device was infected with Pegasus or subject to an attempt hack, The Guardian noted the consortium believes that the data is indicative of the potential targets NSO's government clients identified in advance of possible surveillance attempts. Amnesty Security Lab analyzed a small sample of phones belonging to activists, journalists, and lawyers whose numbers appeared on the leaked list. Of the 67 phones examined, traces of Pegasus spyware were found on 37 devices, including 23 that had been successfully infected and 14 with signs of attempt hacking. NSO claims its spyware is undetectable and only used for legitimate criminal investigations. Etienne Manier, a technologist at Amnesty's security lab, said in a statement, adding, "We have now provided irrefutable evidence of this ludicrous falsehood." According to the Post, the list does not identify who put the numbers on it or why, and it is unknown how many of the phones were targeted or surveilled. But forensic analysis of the 37 smartphones shows that many display a tight correlation between the timestamps associated with the number on the list and the initiation of surveillance, in some cases as brief as a few seconds. The numbers on the list are unattributed, but reporters were able to identify more than 1,000 people spanning more than 50 countries through research and interviews on four continents. Several Arab royal family members, at least 67 business executives, 85 human rights activists, 189 journalists, and more than 600 politicians and government officials, including cabinet ministers, diplomats, and military and security officers. The numbers of several heads of state and prime ministers also appeared on the list. Among the journalists whose numbers appear on the list, which dates to 2016, are reporters working overseas for several leading news organizations, including small number from CNN, the Associated Press, the Voice of America, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg News, Le Monde in France, the Financial Times in London, and Al Jazeera in Qatar. Newspaper added that Amnesty found evidence of NSO's spyware being used by Saudi Arabia and UAE regimes to target the phones of close associates of Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi before and after he was brutally murdered by Saudi operatives in 2018. The Pegasus project lays bare how NSO's spyware is a weapon of choice for repressive governments seeking to silence journalists, attack activists, and crush dissent, placing countless lives in peril, Agnes Callamard, Secretary General of Amnesty International, said in a statement recently. These revelations, Callamard continued, blow apart any claims by NSO that such attacks are rare and down to rogue use of their technology. While the company claims its spyware is only used for legitimate criminal and terror investigations, it's clear its technology facilitates systematic abuse. They paint a picture of legitimacy while profiting from widespread human rights violations. Callamard emphasized that NSO's actions pose larger questions about the wholesale lack of regulation that has created a wild west of rampant abusive targeting of activists and journalists. Until this company and the industry as a whole can show it is capable of respecting human rights, she added, there must be an immediate moratorium on the export, sale, transfer, and use of surveillance technology. NSO, for its part, issued a statement denying claims in the report, including those related to Khashoggi. Attorneys for the company argued that Pegasus Project's investigation was based on wrong assumptions and uncorroborated theories. The company claimed that it is pursuing a life-saving mission to stamp out crime. The Guardian noted that while the consortium found numbers in the data belonging to suspected criminals, the broad array of numbers in the list belonging to people who seemingly have no connection to criminality suggests some NSO clients are breaching their contracts with the company, spying on pro-democracy activists and journalists, investigating corruption as well as political opponents and government critics. According to the Post, after the investigation began, several reporters in the consortium learned that they or their family members had been successfully attacked with Pegasus spyware. In response, Calamard stressed that the number of journalists identified as targets vividly illustrates how Pegasus is used as a tool to intimidate critical media. It is about controlling the public narrative, resisting scrutiny, and suppressing any dissenting voice. These revelations must act as a catalyst for change, said Calamard. The surveillance industry must no longer be afforded a laissez-faire approach from governments with a vested interest in using this technology to commit human rights violations. The human rights expert demanded that NSO immediately shut down client system where there is credible evidence of misuse. She added that the Pegasus project provides this in abundance. NSO stated that it will continue to investigate all credible claims of misuse and take appropriate action based on the results of these investigations. Timothy Summers, a former cybersecurity engineer at a U.S. intelligence agency and now director of IT at Arizona State University, told the Post that Pegasus is nasty software. One could use the technology, said Summers, to spy on almost the entire world population. The Guardian noted that the Pegasus project will be revealing the identities of people whose number appeared on the list in the coming days. Amnesty's Manier said that our hope is the damning evidence published over the next week will lead governments to overhaul a surveillance industry that is out of control.
Ministry.
In May, tensions in occupied Palestine escalated and the Israeli occupation launched yet another deadly war on Gaza. This assault, as well as the threat of expulsion of Palestinians from occupied East Al-Quds and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, which triggered Palestinian protests, are all just another chapter in the 73-year-old Palestinian Nakba. But these events demonstrate something very important: the failure of the normalization deals, the so-called Abraham Accords, or the deal of the century between four Arab countries and Israel, concluded in 2020. These agreements were heavily advertised as promoting peace in West Asia and reining in Israeli expansionist policies in Palestine. But as anticipated, they have proven to have failed in both. The announcement of the normalization of ties with Israel came laden with promises that it will help bring peace to Palestine, but it stopped the Israeli plan to annex parts of the occupied West Bank and supposedly opened the door to economic development for the entire region. But what has transpired since has proven that these agreements were a mere business transaction steered by former U.S. President Donald Trump, who did all he could to accommodate all of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's whims. The main outcome of the normalization deals is that the UAE is set to become a major trading partner for Israel after it abandoned the decades-old Arab boycott of Israel. Economic relations between Bahrain and Israel are also likely to intensify. Nothing for Sudan and Morocco, though, except the two countries are set to reap the benefits of their own small political wins facilitated by the U.S. easing its sanctions. None of these deals changed the situation on the ground in the region's hot spots, particularly in Palestine, as the events of the past few months demonstrate. Israel continues to be engaged in systematic ethnic cleansing of Palestinians in Gaza, past state laws that discriminate against non-Jews as they trample over Palestinians' religious rights and continue to threaten native Palestinians with forced expulsion from their homes. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. Over the past few months, tensions in Palestine have escalated as the Israeli occupation launched yet another deadly war on Gaza. This aggression, as well as the threat of displacing Palestinian natives from occupied East Al-Quds Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood and the Israeli raids on Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan, which by the way triggered a lot of Palestinian protests, were a demonstration of the failure of the so-called normalization deals, or the deal of the century, between four Arab countries and Israel. These agreements were heavily advertised as promoting peace in the Middle East and reining in Israeli expansionist policies inside of Palestine, but they have proven to have failed in both. To discuss this issue with us from Madrid is Alberto Garcia Watson, journalist and political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Alberto, now the ongoing Israeli aggression against Palestinians demonstrates that the normalization deals have basically just failed between these four Arab states and the Israeli entity. But why were these deals brokered then, if not for peace?
Because actually it was never intended to be for peace. It was actually expected that this last attack on Gaza was going to take place, and there were all the signs threatening with Gaza and the resistance groups with a major attack. So however, this was a kind of distraction campaign to try to keep everyone distracted with the struggle for peace of the Americans and the Israelis, but it was never intended to be, it was never an intention of actually bringing peace to the region. As I said, it was just a distraction, and these countries unfortunately went for it. And they went for it because they were also bribed, because of, in the case of Morocco, it was the sovereignty of Morocco over the Occidental Sahara, which was a territory under the control of the Spaniards. When it comes to Sudan, were also different bribes given to that country, and also Bahrain, and we'll see other countries that will move in too. So it's actually never intended to bring peace to the region, and as I see very clearly, the intention of making out of Palestine a kind of an autonomous region under the control and the security of Israel will never be accepted by Palestinians.
Well, Alberto, Israel continued after the deals its engagement in Palestinian ethnic cleansing and in bringing out laws that discriminate against whoever is not Jew, and by discriminating also against the religious practices of Palestinians, whether they are Muslims or Christians. They even tried to displace people within the occupied Al-Quds Sharif. We have been seeing that since May in the occupied Sheikh Al-Jarrah neighborhood. One blockaded, carpet-bombed Gaza was able to stop them, was able to halt the Israeli expansionist plan and their aggression against the occupied territories. Will the sides involved in this deal be able to salvage what is left of it after what happened with Gaza?
What happened with Gaza was an attention that the resistance sent very clear after crossing the red lines that are Haram al-Sharif, the compound of the Al-Aqsa Mosque that was desecrated by settlers and militaries, and the attempt on evacuating the population of Sheikh Jarrah and what they're doing, for example, now with Tier 1, resistance made it very clear. There are red lines that Israelis cannot cross, and they learned under this last conflict with Gaza that basically the Israelis can not only have Mahmoud Abbas as a reference to deal with, but they're going to have to deal with the resistance, because everything is pointing at the power that the resistance now has will put Israel in its place. So that's why the deal of the century is never going to get through while the resistance is active, and the resistance has shown that they're going to rule from now on any opposition to the brutal occupation of the Israeli entity.
It was truly interesting, Alberto, to see Israeli far-right groups who feel emboldened by their electoral alliance with the new Prime Minister Bennett, who also stepped up harassment against the Palestinians, if I may. Some of them marched in Jerusalem a couple of weeks back, and they were chanting death to Arabs, and the entire world was watching them. But how do you think the latest Palestinian revolt, whether in Al-Quds or in the occupied West Bank, will maybe further affect the scene inside the Palestinian territories, especially after the assassination of a very prominent activist like Nizar Banat and the arrest of several others?
Well, what we saw that day, the day that the Israelis called the Day of the Flag in Jerusalem, it was not just assassinate and kill the Arabs. There were some groups that even went as far as chanting, tonight we're not Jews, tonight we are Nazis. That far they got. And this provocation that actually was allowed even by the Israeli authorities gave very much the knowledge of what is the mentality of the new government that is basically created by different groups of radicals, especially extreme radical Jews that are in this government, and that are trying to see how far they can get and how far can the Palestinians take it. What happened also with the Nizar Banat, the killing of Nizar Banat by the Palestinian National Authority, because of denouncing the collaborationism of Abbas with Israelis, it's putting a lot of Palestinians today in the territories, especially in Jerusalem and the rest of the West Bank, against the president Mahmoud Abbas. That there shouldn't even be a president at this point, because it's already years ago that he should have been out of power.
Well, after the victories, Alberto, of the Al-Quds sword operation, all allied forces of the resistance in the region, going from Beirut to Damascus to Baghdad to Tehran to Sana'a, they all voiced their support and their readiness to engage in order to support and fight back the Zionist entity from Al-Quds al-Sharif. How viable do you think this new equation in reality is?
Well, the new equation, if you let me share a fact with you, is that in the last year, 50,000 Israelis have left Israel. And they have asked for dual citizenship, especially in Europe and the United States and Russia and other countries, because the big dream of the Zionists was actually to find a home, a national home for the Jews that were prosecuted around the world, and a place where they could feel secure. Today, Israelis do not feel secure anymore. Today, the Israelis are starting to feel what many Palestinians have been suffering for the past seven decades. And it's terror and it's fear. It's no stability in the country, and it's definitely no security. And this is one of the achievements of the resistance, and is that the fear has changed sides.
I want to thank you very much, Alberto Garcia-Watson, journalist and political commentator, for joining us to talk about the failure of the deal of the century, especially after the latest Israeli assault on Gaza and the occupied internal Palestinian territories. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned. Next, we will be talking about how the U.S. continues to demonize the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday